What are the Palantiri, those magical seeing stones in The Lord of the Rings? What can they do, and what's their history? Let's take a look. Hi everyone, this is Robert. Welcome to In Deep Geek. Here we cover The Lord of the Rings and Tolkien's wider legendarium in full, as well as covering other great fantasy worlds like A Song of Ice and Fire and The Witcher. Tolkien was a great lover of myth and legend, and often took ideas that he found there and put his own spin on them, so that when we discover them in his stories, we already have an instinctive understanding of what we are looking at. As such, the Palantiri were Tolkien's take on the crystal balls, traditionally associated with divination and far-seeing. But as well as the similarities, they are perfect spheres made of dark, semi-translucent crystal through which you can see things magically that others can't. There are, of course, differences. And rare for Tolkien, he explains and quantifies a lot of the magic going on here. Most of the time, he uses quite a soft magic system, keeping the mystery of magic by not explaining exactly how it works. But here, he gives more details. We get the fullest description of how they work in Unfinished Tales, but essentially, Palantir means that which looks far away, and this was their primary function as a sort of magical telescope. Their optical zoom was most effective at a certain distance. For the smaller Palantiri, which were about a foot in diameter, it was about 500 miles. Much nearer or further would be blurry, like looking through lenses of the wrong prescription. The greater Palantiri, however, some of which were too large even to lift, could see greater distances, thousands of miles. And it wasn't just distance they could look through. Palantiri could also look far away in time, to the past. The further back in time, the clearer. So you couldn't easily look back to things that happened last week, say. For example, despite Aragorn knowing on March the 16th that Frodo had been on Henneth Annwn on March the 8th, he could not have used the Orthanc stone to follow Frodo's movements from that time to the present. It would be like looking through a telescope at a person an inch away. Another limitation is that, like a telescope in their function of viewing far-off times and places, Palantiri can only receive images, not sounds. They can see through objects, such as walls, by zooming in and out, but cannot see things in the dark. You still needed your own eyesight. And crucially, also like a telescope, you only see things in the exact direction in which you are looking through the Palantir. You can't just pick it up and see anything. You have to look in the right direction. There's an important story point here. When Pippin picked up the Orthanc stone and looked into and saw Sauron, or Sauron saw him, Tolkien is clear that it was by chance, as men call it, that he was pointing towards Mordor. He could have been looking towards the Lonely Mountain, or the Shire, or some random place down in Far Harad, but no. The clear implication is that he was meant to do that, and it was fortunate because Sauron was looking for a hobbit and found one. Just the wrong one. Anyway, a secondary function of the Palantir is for long-distance video calls. Again, this doesn't actually involve sound. It's all about transferred thoughts. Tolkien tells us that the Palantiri could not themselves survey men's minds at unawares or unwilling. Hence, this sometimes becomes a bit of a battle of wills, such as when Aragorn and Sauron connected by the Palantir. So, that's what they were. But why were they in Middle-earth? Where did they come from? When Gandalf explains the Palantiri to Pippin, he says that they come from beyond the Western Ess, from Eldamar. The Noldor made them. Feanor himself, maybe, wrought them in days so long ago that the time cannot be measured in years. Feanor was the greatest elvish craftsman. He would go on to make the Silmarils. And Gandalf was right in guessing that he was indeed their inventor, and fashioned the first few at least in Valinor. That said, we don't know much more about their creation, or even how many were made. We're told that the masters who could make them were few, and that their making was even beyond the art of either Sauron or Saruman, so no more could be made in Middle-earth. The only ones that were there were ones that came over from Valinor, and they could not be replaced. Not that destroying them would be easy, because they were indeed unbreakable by any violence then controlled by men, though some believed that great heat such as that of Orodruin might shatter them. So they were forged back in the mists of time in Valinor. How did some of them end up in Middle-earth? Tolkien doesn't tell us all the details, but they ended up in the Second Age of Middle-earth on Tol Eressëa, the island just off the coast of Valinor. Perhaps Fëanor and the Noldor elves took them with them to Middle-earth, then they got brought back in the chaos of the War of Roth. We don't know, but they were definitely on Tol Eressëa towards the end of the Second Age. The Second Age was the Age of Numenor, and for many years there was a positive relationship between Numenor and the elves of Tol Eressëa. But then, as the Second Age drew to a close, the shadow fell on Numenor, and only a minority of Numenoreans kept the faith. The Tol Eressëan elves were not permitted anymore to travel to Numenor. So towards the end of the Second Age, seven of the Palantiri were given to the elf friends of Numenor, specifically to Amandil, grandfather of Isildur, as a comfort to the faithful, as the elves would no longer be permitted to visit Numenor. At least one Palantir, the Masterstone, was kept in Tol Eressëa so they could keep in contact, or at least see Avalone, and one of the seven was locked onto that. Numenor fell near the end of the Second Age, but the faithful managed to smuggle the seven Palantiri out in the fleets of Elendil, Isildur, and Anarion. They were accounted the greatest of all the treasures preserved from Numenor, equal only to the White Tree saved by Isildur. When Elendil and his sons established their two successor states, Arnor and Gondor, they placed these Palantiri in strategic locations. Gondor possessed four stones. Three of these were minor stones, though still very powerful, each about a foot in diameter and more limited in their capabilities. They were situated in Minas Anor, which became Minas Tirith, Minas Ithil, which became Minas Morgul, and Isengard, which for most of its history was a possession of Gondor, not Saruman. Then there was a larger Palantir, which had some control over those other three stones, which resided in the Dome of the Stars in Osgiliath, the original capital of Gondor. In Arnor's original capital, Annúminas, was another minor stone. Their major stone was atop Weathertop, a crucial lookout point and watchtower, where much later the Nazgûl attacked Frodo. Arnor's third stone was unlike the others, and not capable of communicating with them. This was the one which looked ever westward. It was kept atop the Tower of Elrond, the tallest of the three elven towers just beyond the borders of the Shire. Elendil set it there so that he could look back with straight sight and see Eressëa in the vanishing west. The idea was that the two kingdoms could use the stones to more easily communicate with each other and keep an eye on their kingdoms, which was a good idea but doomed to failure. By the time of the Lord of the Rings, most were lost or forgotten. Over several centuries, the northern kingdom of Arnor was slowly destroyed, first dividing into three smaller kingdoms of Arthedain, Cardolan, and Rhudor, then falling bit by bit to the relentless assaults of the Witch King of Angmar. Arthedain was the last to fall, and removed the Weathertop and Annúminas stones to the city of Fornost. King Ardawi's desperate plea for help from the southern kingdom of Gondor was probably the last time those stones were used. Sadly, that help was too late in coming, and Ardawi had to abandon his city, taking the two Palantiri with him into exile north, where he was given shelter by the Lossoth people. Círdan sent a ship to bring them to safety, but it had barely set off back with them when ice broke its hull, and both Palantiri, as well as the king and many others, died, lost at the bottom of the frozen sea. The third northern stone, their Elrond stone, may have technically been owned by Arnor, but had hardly been used by humans other than Elendil. That was the one that was locked onto a view of the island of Tol Eressëa, so less useful in terms of governing the kingdom. And with the kingdom of Arnor now gone, Círdan kept it where it was, but under lock and key, under his protection. It was lost from human memory, though elves still travelled there from time to time to gaze westwards. So that's what happened to the three stones of the kingdom of Arnor. Meanwhile, in Gondor, things were also not going well. A marriage between the heir to the throne and a woman of apparent lesser lineage led to a succession crisis and subsequent civil war known as the Kin Strife. During this, in 1437, the capital city Osgiliath was besieged and burned, with parts collapsing into the Anduin River, including the tower holding its palantir. The stone sank into the waters and was lost forevermore. That left three. Another fell in the year 2002 of the Third Age. The Nazgul sacked Minas Ithil, known afterwards as Minas Morgul, and the Ithil stone went missing. It was taken to Barad-dûr, and this was the one that Sauron was using during The Lord of the Rings. Although nobody knew for sure that it had fallen into the hands of the enemy, the possibility was taken very seriously, particularly as that stone was the Palantir most closely in accord with that of Minas Tirith. So none of the kings or stewards of Gondor dared to use the Minas Tirith stone until Denethor. It was kept hidden and known only to the ruler of Minas Tirith, and therefore largely forgotten by everyone else. The final stone, the Orthanc stone, was also forgotten over centuries. More tragedies struck Gondor, and their kingdom shrank, and Orthanc, an impregnable fortress built with Numenorean technology or magic none now understood, was as good a place as any to hide the potentially dangerous artifact. When Saruman took over the keys to Orthanc later in the Third Age, it will actually have felt like a blessing to the stewards of Gondor. They had long since given up using the stones, and who better to entrust with its safety than the head of the White Council himself? Not that Saruman had told anyone he was looking for it, or had found it. Which brings us up to the build-up to The Lord of the Rings. Of the seven original stones, three were now lost at the bottom of the seas, and one was under Círdan's control, but could only look west anyway. But the other three would all play a role in the war to come. One was in Sauron's control in Barad-dûr, and the other two had not been used for a very long time, but were in possession of Saruman and Denethor. Before Saruman dared to use his, Denethor did, the first ruling steward to do so, probably immediately upon becoming steward in 2984. This is evidenced by the fact that he was unusually aged for one of Numenorean noble descent. There was a certain strain inherent to using the Palantiri, though this was less for one with the authority to use them, as with Aragorn and Denethor. Such strain Denethor could probably have endured. His ageing was primarily due to contesting his will against Sauron's. We often dismiss Denethor as being weak, but that's not how Tolkien saw it, defending Denethor's actions a little. He must have guessed that the Ithil stone was in evil hands and risked contact with it, trusting his strength. His trust was not entirely unjustified. Sauron failed to dominate him and could only influence him by deceits. Contrast that with Saruman, a Maia of greater intrinsic power but less right to wield the Palantir. He finally used his own stone around the year 3000, probably as part of his search for the ring. Whereas Denethor strove against Sauron, Saruman quickly came under the Dark Lord's domination. Even so, using the Palantiri was not like using the ring. They were neither made nor controlled by Sauron, nor was he always aware of when one of them was being used. As Tolkien says, the stones were only a small item in Sauron's vast designs and operations, a means of dominating and deluding two of his opponents. But he would not, and could not, have the Ithil stone under perpetual observation. It was not his way to commit such instruments to subordinates, nor had he any servants whose mental powers were superior to Saruman's, or even Denethor's. So Denethor and Saruman often used their Palantiri for observation without making contact with Sauron, Saruman looking for the ring, and Denethor obsessing over the strength of Mordor and the rise of Aragorn. Sometime after the Uruks captured Merry and Pippin, Saruman ceased to regularly report to Sauron via his Palantir. Thinking that one of those hobbits possessed the ring, Saruman ordered them brought to him, betraying his alliance with Mordor. After the Ents captured Isengard and all his plans crashed down around him, Saruman refused Gandalf's overtures, thinking that he could explain his actions to Sauron via the stone. But this is when fate intervened. Grímer, not knowing the Palantir's power or purpose, tried to kill Saruman with it, or perhaps Gandalf, by hurling it at them. Whatever his target, he missed, and the stone was recovered by Pippin. This was important because it meant that on March the 5th and 6th, Pippin and Aragorn respectively made contact with Sauron through the Palantir. Pippin, not really knowing what he was doing, just being a took, and Aragorn intentionally. Sauron speculated, wrongly, about what he then saw, and his actions were then guided by a very wrong idea of what was going on. On seeing Pippin, Sauron decided that this hobbit must have been the ring-bearer, captive in Isengard, and dispatched a Nazgul there to retrieve it. On seeing Aragorn several hours later, Sauron then assumed that Isildur's heir had overthrown Orthanc and taken the ring for himself. Such speculation directly contributed to Sauron's downfall. As Aragorn intended, it drew the eye away from Mordor, allowing Frodo to pass through unseen by Sauron. When Aragorn later marched on Mordor itself, it was clearly a bluff, but a bluff that only worked because of what Sauron had seen through the Palantir and the assumptions he had made. Such is a fascinating example of an object with power over nature, the machine, as Tolkien would term it, of being not merely a tool of the enemy, but dangerous in and of itself, even to the enemy. Still, Aragorn used it for good. Upon mastering the stone, he also used it to perceive the peril of the Corsairs of Umbar, a force coming to attack Minas Tirith from the south, and decided to pass through the paths of the dead to deal with it. Without this, Minas Tirith may well have fallen. The next known use of a Palantir occurred on March the 13th, within an hour of Faramir returning wounded to Minas Tirith. It was only in this final confrontation with Sauron that Denethor was finally driven to full despair. Sauron showed him the black sails of the Corsairs coming up the Anduin. Denethor speculated that this fleet would be reinforcing the forces of Mordor, tipping the scales further in its favour. In truth, Aragorn had by then captured the Corsairs at Pelagia earlier that day and was racing to rescue the city. Denethor saw disaster, where really there was salvation. Driven to his despair, Denethor committed self-immolation upon a funerary pyre on the early hours of March the 15th, clasping the Arnor stone as he burned. And it was said that ever after, if any man looked in that stone, for it was not destroyed by the fire, unless he had great strength of will to turn it to other purpose, he saw only two aged hands withering in flame. 10 days later, on March the 25th, Mount Doom erupted, and its fires were presumed to have destroyed the Ithil stone in Barad-dûr. Finally, on September the 29th, 3021, Círdan placed the Elostirion stone aboard the Ringbearer's ship to Avalonne. Thus, at the start of the Fourth Age, only two Palantiri remained in Middle-earth. Three had been drowned, the Osgiliath stone in the Anduin and the Annúminas and Amon Sul stones in Forakel in the Frozen North. One more was destroyed or buried so deep underground to never be found again, the Ithil stone at Barad-dûr, and one went west, the Elostirion stone. Of the two that remained, due to Denethor, few had sufficient strength of will to make use of that one, but the Orthanc stone remained ever after in Aragorn's possession, and he used it for the purpose it was intended, as king to survey what was happening throughout his realm. He presumably passed the Palantir down to his successors, but what became of it in ages to come is an untold tale. Palantiri were never going to just be Tolkien's take on crystal balls. Incredibly powerful and given as a gift, they could and should have blessed the land. But like so many technologies, if they are approached with ill intent or arrogance, they can do much harm. Or, deeper still, Tolkien uses the Palantiri to show us more about the person using them than the technology itself. Denethor's despair leads him to see enemies approaching Minas Tirith, when in fact it is friends. Sauron sees a hobbit, then Aragorn, and assumes that Aragorn has seized the ring for himself, because that's what Sauron would do. Grímur, usually so subtle and nefarious, throws the Orthanc stone in anger, because that's who he really is under the surface inside, a very angry man. Tolkien may have given us magical seeing stones, but as a literary device, he used them like a mirror. If you'd like to see more videos about the world of the Lord of the Rings, please click on the link to my playlist on the left of your screen. Or to support this channel, the best way to do that is by clicking on the link on the right of your screen. That's all for this time. Thanks for watching. I'll see you again soon.